From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Today on the show, we'll have the latest on Milwaukee Police Chief Edward Flynn's retirement announcement.
Plus, why a program at UW-Madison's School of Medicine and Public Health focuses on training medical students in Milwaukee.
Later, Milwaukee County works to recruit more people to be mental health nurses.
What we're trying to target are the so-called millennials and maybe folks seeking a second career who are really cut out for this work and have a passion for this work.
And our Beats Me segment examines what happens to the stuff you leave at the curb for the recycling truck.
Anything that's not number one, he's going to pull out, put back on the belt for everybody else to sort. Right there, they're doing nothing but milk jugs all day.
Lake Effect is next. News is first.
This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for joining us. I'm Audrey Nowakowski.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Milwaukee Police Chief Edward Flynn announced yesterday he's stepping down from his position in February after 10 years in office. The retirement announcement came in the midst of a controversial time for Flynn.
Flynn's departure follows increasing criticism from some city leaders and community members. But as WUWM's Annalise Hensel reports, the chief says that's not the reason for his decision.
Police Chief Edward Flynn is halfway through his third term in office. It was slated to end in 2 years, but the chief says now that he's served for a decade, he's ready to go.
It's a good benchmark, and it's time.
Flynn added he feels comfortable leaving the post because he's met key objectives.
My goal for us was to turn around the homicide numbers that had climbed so high in my 8th year and to reach 10 years moving forward in the right direction. Both goals have been met.
The chief was quick to dismiss the idea that his departure has anything to do with increasingly loud criticism, including from the Milwaukee Common Council. Aldermen voted last fall to give themselves the power to fire police chiefs.
People who do, and people who criticize, I guess, you know, some of them become aldermen.
Milwaukee Mayor Tom Barrett joined Flynn for his announcement. Over the years, he's backed Flynn and maintained his support Monday afternoon.
He's professional. He's innovative. And he cares about the residents of this community.
However, those who've expressed concerns about Flynn had a different reaction. Alderman Tony Zielinski was pleased the chief is leaving. Zielinski has been one of the chief's most vocal critics in city government.
Crime, fear, and disorder is at unacceptable levels.
Zielinski says Flynn hasn't been responsive to elected officials or others who've wanted to share their concerns about police policy. The alderman points to one of Flynn's most controversial policies regarding officers' pursuit of fleeing vehicles.
His policy of not pursuing contributed to mobile drug houses, reckless driving, vehicle theft, joyriding, because they knew that the police weren't going to chase them.
The Fire and Police Commission forced Flynn to change that policy. Zielinski says he's encouraged the police department can move in a new direction with Flynn's departure. So is community advocate Vaughn Mays. But he says there are big questions about whether the next chief will take steps to improve the relationship between police and the Black community.
Who comes in next and what type of relationship building they'll be open to?
Among other concerns, African American leaders have complained about officers' illegal strip and body cavity searches of people they suspect have drugs. Mays also says he wants to see changes in the department based on recommendations in a preliminary U.S. Department of Justice report that was leaked to the media. Flynn has blasted it. Mays says the reaction is part of Flynn's, quote, bullheaded approach and unwillingness to admit to mistakes.
He's maintained that his entire time. And I think that's a bad attitude to have.
The Latino group LULAC also reacted to news of Flynn's retirement. Spokesman Daryl Marine says his organization worked with the chief on a host of issues. He says Flynn was an effective chief initially.
It became obvious towards the end that the relationship that everyone would hope would exist between the communities and all the members of law enforcement wasn't what I think everyone hoped it could be.
Police Chief Flynn's retirement will be effective February 16th. The city's Fire and Police Commission will begin talking about its next steps later this week. Members say one of the first orders of business will be to search for an acting chief from within the department. The commission says it will look for someone who has the respect of the department and the community at large. I'm Annalise Henzel, 89.7 WUWM.
You can read more about Chief Flynn's departure and his time in office at WUWM.com.
The University of Wisconsin Medical School's Training in Urban Medicine and Public Health, or TRIUMPH program, was founded 9 years ago in an effort to better prepare students for the realities of practicing medicine in urban communities. While the medical school is part of the university's Madison campus, the TRIUMPH program is based here in Milwaukee and partners with a number of organizations and providers in the city.
Since it was created, dozens of students have gone through the program, and all of them have selected residencies in urban areas. TRIUMPH is now headed by Dr. Shersti Knox, who is a physician at the Aurora Sinai Family Care Center. She joins us now, along with Dr. Teresa Umhafer-Witry, who is Associate Director of TRIUMPH, in addition to being a pediatrician and child and adolescent psychiatrist at Wheaton Franciscan in Racine. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you so much for having us.
Yeah, it's truly a pleasure.
Can you speak more to the realities of practicing medicine in an urban environment that the TRIUMPH program seeks to address?
We know that health is dictated by many things, but over half or at least half of that are social and environmental factors, like social, your economic status, your environment that you live in, those sorts of factors.
Those are the sorts of factors, though, that doctors can't necessarily fix the way they can fix a broken arm or you know, heal strep throat.
We can't necessarily fix them in the office, but I think what's really important for us to recognize and for any caregiver to recognize is how much they influence health and how much we need to take those into account in any encounter with the patient and with our communities. And one of the goals of the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health is to improve population health and public health. And so being able to identify what those factors are and then work with our partners in the community on how we can improve them is really, really important to taking care of our patients.
Well, so how does that work on a practical level?
Well, I think one of the major things with the TRIUMPH program is that they leave Madison, which is where the traditional medical curriculum is, and they come to Milwaukee. And not only are they doing the standard medical curriculum that all of their peers at Madison are doing, but they also have additional coursework focused on community engagement. They have a longitudinal community health project that really gets them involved on a more ground level with organizations that are doing some of this work here in Milwaukee to address different social determinants of health. So it's really in addition to the standard medical curriculum that these students take on when they join the TRIUMPH program.
Is the assumption that someone who is going through the TRIUMPH program, is it the assumption that person is going to graduate and go on to practice medicine in an environment either like Milwaukee or Milwaukee itself?
Yes, that's the goal. So one of the main additional goals is to train physicians who can work in urban underserved areas. And what we've found so far with our graduates is that all of our graduates have gone into residencies in that serve urban underserved communities. And many of them have continued, of those who have graduated from residency at this point, have come back to Milwaukee to practice or are going into other urban underserved environments.
Mm-hmm. Can we talk more specifically about the kinds of social issues that are, you know, social determinants? You know, why is it different when you're seeing somebody in, you know, who might have diabetes in an urban mm-hmm. setting versus in a suburban setting?
I mean, I think that there are a lot of different factors that go into the special set of challenges that come for caring for the kind of urban underserved population. You know, everything from the environment in which they live, their access to fresh foods at grocery mm-hmm. stores, their access to medical care, their ability to get to medical care due to a lot of transportation issues, and also, you know, the mistrust that some of these populations have with the medical system, or they're immigrant populations that haven't, you know, assimilated into the system. It's just a unique set of challenges that we don't often think of with patients from more suburban type areas. Also, you have to consider the violence that they're exposed to, you know, in their environments. It's just a unique set of needs that if you're not aware of them and not asking the right questions, you can completely be missing the mark and being like, why isn't this getting any better? I've told you everything to do. But if they can't get to the pharmacy to get the medication, or they don't have the money for the copay, or they can't afford the right foods, or they don't have transportation to get to the doctor's office. I mean, these are all things that are impacting, you know, say diabetes, but for many other diseases as well.
And what I would add to that is that at least in my own practice, what I've seen is that the effects of racism, the effects of violence or trauma, those aren't things that you necessarily see on someone's skin or on the outside, but we see that manifest itself in things like high blood pressure. And I know people who have worked across the country and across the globe say that until Milwaukee, they were working in Milwaukee, they'd never seen such high blood pressures in patients. So we see those stressors manifest themselves in different ways.
So with that kind of enhanced understanding, how does your approach to say something like high blood pressure change?
First of all, I think the conversation about access to food, Teresa was talking about, is an important one. Just asking what else is going on, in particular if we're seeing changes that fluctuate from one visit to the next, that are extreme changes, saying, okay, what's going on today? We haven't seen your blood pressure. Does that surprise you? And often with just asking some of those simple questions that open up the door for patients to respond and share, well, actually, this or that thing has happened this week that really is causing a lot of stress for me or for my family that I'm working through.
What do you think it is that attracts some medical students to this particular work? And I guess what was it that attracted each of you to doing this work as well?
I think I honestly went into medical school thinking, you know, that this was the type of population that I wanted to serve and that my skill set could be best used by. My mom was a social worker growing up, so our house was always full of these types of stories. And I think from that, you know, really felt like this is where the work needs to be done. And it was actually my training in the Triumph program that led me to pursuing a combined residency in pediatrics and child and adolescent psychiatry and adult psychiatry, because I really saw the need for mental health services for this population and how not only the kids but the adults are really kind of suffering. And if you can't address that, you really can't address, you know, their entire well-being. And so for me, you know, just being exposed to it, you know, from stories from my mom growing up and then coming through the Triumph program really has solidified that, you know, this is kind of where I'm meant to work and use my skills.
Sharcy Knox, what attracted you to the field?
Well, I had the opportunity to do a Fulbright Fellowship in health policy in Sweden. And during that year, I really came to feel really passionate about thinking about how do we take care of underserved populations. And that during that time, then started to consider medicine, and which brought me to the University of Wisconsin based on their programs, both in serving underserved populations in Madison through what's called the MEDIC program, which is a free clinic program. And then while they're, again, similar to Teresa, the Triumph program developed, and it was such a great match and opportunity to come to Milwaukee. And while initially, I think the goals of the program really have been to train physicians to work in underserved areas because we need physicians. These are areas that need more physicians. Ultimately, the reason that I discovered to be in Triumph was not really to come to fix that problem, but to be able to be part of a program and a community that was looking at the assets that we had in Milwaukee and the things that all of not just Triumph, but so many people and so many programs within Milwaukee are trying to address these various health concerns from different angles. And I think that really just lit my fire even more, because being able to work with a group of people that are so passionate and can look and see the assets that are available to us is really powerful.
Do you see Triumph in a position to be a convener, or, you know, someone who can help drive the collaboration between these sort of disparate groups and organizations that exist to serve these populations? Or do you see yourself as one of the organizations that needs to be coordinated with these other groups?
I see us as both. I think in some circumstances, we're very much at the table trying to add our piece to a conversation that's already happening. At the same time, I think one of the really fun parts about what we get to do is meeting with people from the different organizations where our students work, and identifying where there are connections with other programs we're working with, and connecting people in that way too. So I think we get to do both.
How do you draw the students to this program?
Well, right now it's not a problem. We have an overabundance of applicants and people in the program, which is absolutely phenomenal. I think that as the Triumph program has expanded, I mean, it started as a very small cohort of people and now has expanded to 16, as well as people with an MPH program. And now we also have second year students. So the numbers have really expanded. And I think that people have had such a positive experience, and it's really actually drawing people to apply to the University of Madison from out of state because it's starting to really kind of get a lot of buzz with it.
I was going to ask whether there are other programs at other medical schools around the country that work in this way.
There are a few others, but I think that Triumph is really unique, like Teresa was saying, and just in our ability to expand so quickly and the amount of popularity of the program. And we're excited this year, starting Monday,
yeah.
We will for the first time be accepting, or for the first time we will have second year medical students coming. So we will be expanding the number of students that are in Milwaukee in the Triumph program by a third even. So we'll have roughly 50 students here at various points in their medical or MPH careers as part of the program.
There are obviously other cities in Wisconsin with populations that are dealing with many of the same issues that the underserved population in Milwaukee does. Is it your hope that students who go through Triumph will go on to those other cities, or could Triumph expand to places like Racine and Kenosha and Green Bay and other cities where, you know, there are likewise some very underserved populations?
Well, right now we're very excited about growing the program within Milwaukee. We're not planning at this point to expand to those cities, but I think we are. We're excited, for instance, to have Teresa working in Racine and other graduates in other places that can carry the lessons that they've learned with us here to wherever their practice is.
Are there other ideas? You were talking about how second-year medical students are now going to be involved. Where else does this program go from here? What's, you know, in an ideal world, what might Triumph look like in 3 or 4 or 5 years?
Man, it's hard to say, because even in the time since I've been in the program and ShareSeeds has done in the program, it's expanded tremendously. I mean, I think one of the biggest expansions has been the MPH option, where students can kind of take a year to complete their MPH, which is kind of a natural fit with a lot of these community health projects. And then it's just expanded it so much in terms of numbers now. I can't even think of where it could go from here.
One thing that we're really excited about is that a lot of the the curriculum that we use here in Milwaukee with the Triumph students has actually expanded back to Madison mm-hmm. and is being incorporated into the common curriculum for all of those, for all of our medical students. So we're happy that we've been able mm-hmm. to inform the curriculum there, and I think that's an ongoing role that we can play for the medical school. But here in Milwaukee, we, with close to 50 students in different projects, one of the great things is just continuing to expand the number of different organizations that we work with as we learn more and more about what other people are doing in the city and how we can contribute.
But your previous point is an interesting one, that the idea that even if you're not in the Triumph program, there mm-hmm. are lessons to be learned from the kinds of things that are being dealt with in it, regardless of where you go on to practice medicine.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I think a lot of times the issues that we see in healthcare well, are amplified in urban settings, but they're important lessons for anyone to learn, regardless of where you're practicing as well.
Cher Steenox is a physician at Aurora Sinai Family Care Center in Milwaukee and director of the UW Medical School's Triumph Program, training in urban medicine and public health.
Teresa Umhafer-Wittry is associate director and also a pediatrician and child and adolescent psychiatrist at Wheaton Franciscan Healthcare in Racine. You'll find a link to more about Triumph at WUWM.com.
Another effort is going on to recruit more behavioral health nurses in Milwaukee. We'll learn about that when Lakeside continues in a moment on WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Before the break, we talked about an effort to train more medical and public health students to practice in urban settings. But the shortage in medical practitioners in places like Milwaukee is not limited to doctors. There is a nursing shortage as well. And in the midst of all the nursing shortages, the need for mental health nursing is even greater. The Milwaukee County Behavioral Health Division launched a campaign last year to encourage nurses, both old and new, to start careers in the mental health field.
A new round of recruiting is going on this year. We spoke last year with two people involved in the campaign. V. Lucas is a behavioral health nurse, and she and BHD administrator Mike Lappin joined me in the studio to talk about the campaign and why the need for mental health nurses is so prevalent in Milwaukee. Mike Lappin and V. Lucas, welcome to Lake Effect. Thanks for being here today.
Thank you for having us.
Yes, thank you.
So, Mike, I'm going to read you a statement that BHD put out, and I want you to explain this move. Purpose, drive, compassion. If these words scare you, need not apply.
Well, we do some very important work at BHD, and we have some challenging environment from time to time, and we deal with some folks who sometimes have come to us on the worst day of their lives. And so if you aren't all those things, it's probably not the job for you.
And is this a new call to action, a new approach to it? It's not exactly a scare tactic, but it's definitely targeting a specific audience.
It is. And what we're trying to target are the so-called millennials and maybe folks seeking a second career who are really cut out for this work and have a passion for this work. Our goal is to really become a national best practice leader in behavioral health and really change the whole perception of our agency. So the Behavioral Health Division has had some challenges in the past, and the goal is to create a future where we're regarded as the best place to get the services that we provide. And in order to do that, we need the best people to deliver those services.
So is that need to change people's perception the reason behind this unique tactic for this campaign?
Yeah, yes, it is. It's also part of the campaign was to make everybody know that we are open for business. And that was the first step in that because of some closures in our long-term care division, folks just assumed that, well, we closed everything and the county's closed and the hospital's closed. So one of the goals of the of this project was to get the word out that, you know, in fact, we're open for business. And then the next goal was to recruit some folks that we felt would be key to the future and to really add. We have so many great staff who do so many awesome things, and they don't get a lot of credit, unfortunately. The negative sort of the news sound bites always sort of focus on the isolated incident, the negatives, the things we haven't done, the problems we've had in the past. So the goal is to start to focus on the really high quality environment, the fact that we're leaders in so many areas, that we've done all these great things, that we continue to do very positive things for so many folks in our community who really need us.
Why is there currently a shortage of not only nurses nationwide, but in particular mental health care nurses?
So I think, again, it's not for everybody. I think really in general, there's a shortage of nurses. There's been some market trends where I think there's a lot of opportunity for nurses. So if you're providing services in an environment that may be a little more hectic, a little more challenging, I think there's a stigma around mental health and substance use that as far as dangerousness. So I think that stigma impacts us. I also just think it's not on anybody's radar today to be in this field and to provide these services. You know, I honestly sort of fell into this. I did an internship at a hospital and really a couple of weeks into this realized this was the career for me. And so, you know, we have to get the word out that this is an option, this is a career. And I think once folks meet some of our staff or really see what we do and have that experience, they're going to be lifers too.
Do you think that any previous practices contributed to the shortage, either in Milwaukee or abroad, if people went about it the wrong way or if they've heard bad stories or negative news about mental health nursing?
I believe that for us particularly, the biggest factor is this belief that we're closing, that we're not a long-term option. And so I think in an environment where there's great competition, you can understand why if I have five offers, I'm going to go to the place that's going to be for sure there in the future. And I think that's been a challenge, and that even though we really don't have any immediate timetable for any change in our delivery system, I mean, we have, you know, there'll at least be a couple of years where we're operating just at status quo. There is this perception that we already closed. And if we haven't already closed, others are like, well, you guys are closing, right? You know, it's just this general perception in the community. And I think that's a big factor for us. I also, just my observation more globally, is that the sort of helper professions are just not seen as a great career. And I think it's really just people don't know that. They don't understand that it's great pay, great benefits, really sort of creative scheduling and staffing. And we have a lot of flexibility that other industries don't have. We're open 24/7. We're open every holiday, you know. And I think as an industry, we do better, benefits are better, more vacation, better health plans, all these things. But I don't think people really get that, especially the younger folks.
Now, V, your career is very much centered around helping others. So what are some of the challenges you deal with as a mental health nurse compared to other nursing colleagues who are perhaps in a different field of nursing?
In regards to challenges, I'm working with the most vulnerable people in our community. A lot of times the people that organizations may push away. So we're working on a daily basis with the homeless. We have a huge crisis in our city when it comes to homelessness, and I see homeless people every day. We're also working with people with AODA issues such as alcoholism and substance abuse. So that's a huge challenge in itself, because you're not only working with these people, but you're also working with their families. And it's in a broader sense. You can't just focus on the person. You're focusing on all the lives that this one person may affect. This person with substance abuse issues, it's not just that person. It's that person's children. It's that person's wife. And, you know, it just goes beyond just the person. Also, we're working with people who experience traumatic events. One of the most powerful, I guess, examples I can give is one night, I encountered a man that came in, and he had just lost his wife in a car accident. It literally just happened within minutes before him coming to us. Unfortunately, they were in a drunk driver situation. And so literally this man is covered with blood from his wife. And I was his first point of contact. So, I mean, how challenging in that in itself? That's one of the most traumatic events that could happen in a person's life. And I'm the first person that that man is talking to. I'm there to de-escalate that man, and I'm there to try to give him hope, encouragement, and tell him that you're not alone. So, I don't know. I've never heard of any of my friends talking about something as powerful as that, as being there for people when they absolutely need you the most. And I have the opportunity to do that on a nightly basis. So I guess I would say that's challenging in itself.
Absolutely. And with those types of situations, you're not going to typically encounter that on a routine route in a hospital or things like that.
No.
So with mental health nursing, did you have to go through additional requirements and training needed to care for this specific population, these especially vulnerable people?
Yes, we have an awesome orientation program. It's a pretty long program, but we have a lot. We have classroom. So we're learning about different mental illnesses. So we're, you know, schizophrenics, your bipolar, your borderline patients. So we're learning about how to treat the person. And also these people, a lot of times when you have mental illness, you're also carrying on other types of ailments as well. So these people, a lot of times, aren't taking care of their healthcare needs. So you may have a person that comes in and they haven't been on their medications as far as psychiatric, but that means they also may have not been taking their medications for, say, diabetes. So it's treating that whole person, and we learn to do that in that classroom aspect. Also, we have MANT training, so we're trained on how to de-escalate a patient if a patient becomes upset. We learn how to work one-on-one as a team. It's very much a team environment. So we're working with our security that's on board. We're working with our doctors. Our doctors are right there with me. So that's really nice that I have, if I need something, I'm able to say, hey, you know, right there, I need your support, and they're there for me. So it's very team oriented. And we learned that in class, that you very much, it's not just you, but it's a collaboration of professionals working as one to treat these patients.
How did you come into this career in the first place?
So I'm going to be totally honest. I never, ever thought I would be a mental health nurse. When I walked out of school, I wanted to be a labor and delivery nurse. That's what I wanted to do. You know, in college, to be honest, mental health wasn't really promoted. I didn't even have a mental health rotation. I ended up working a little bit in mental health through, I was a CNA prior to nursing, so I had some experience that way, but I never even had a rotation in psychiatric care. So I applied for the job. I seen that there's an open position for the county, and I said, oh, you know, why not? I need a job. I got to pay back my student loans, so let's give it a shot, you know, let's try it. And I got the call back. I got the interview, and I was offered the job right away, and they said, we'd like to place you in psychiatric crisis services. And I'm nodding and smiling, okay, you're not necessarily knowing what I was agreeing to, but it's a decision that I would never take back ever. I absolutely love my job. I love going to work every day. Every day is a new day. There's no 2 days the same. There's no 2 patients the same. So it's the challenge that I need in my life, and it's always exciting. I'm never bored at work. It's not routine at all, and that's what I love about what I do.
You mentioned that you take care of the person as a whole, both the mental and the physical ailments. Do you think it's more effective to deal with it in this manner, or do you think it'd be beneficial to have more nurses with specialties working together, or is the team-centric environment that you have at BHD something that other medical institutions should take note of?
I think the team-centered environment is pretty effective, and we're pretty efficient with treating that whole person. If there's things that we are not trained to do, because we are a psychiatric hospital, we work hand-in-hand with our community hospitals. So, for example, you get a patient who comes in and their blood sugar is 350 and it's untreated. They haven't been on their medications. Well, we will send those patients out to a medical facility. They will be treated, and then they will come back to us, and then we will treat them in regards to their psychiatric needs. So we work hand in hand with community resources.
And Mike, you mentioned that this job isn't for everyone, but what are the goals regarding BHD and this campaign and going forward and bringing your ideal candidates for nursing?
Well, the goal, ideal target group here would be younger nurses, people who are just starting out, recent graduates from, you know, we talked about the millennials or the Generation Y folks who are earlier in their careers, impressionable folks that we can really teach about our models. And then also the second career students. Some folks are coming out of another career. They went back to school. I think the word is getting out that nursing is a industry where opportunities abound. And so it's very important for us to connect with those folks. The folks coming into this field with lots of life experience have a ton to offer for our consumers and for our their colleagues. So the idea is to bring more people in. And again, really, it's about getting the word out about this industry and about our field and really trying to find those folks that, once people experience what V has described in her day-to-day world, it's hard to give that up. And I think that's what you find in this industry is you have folks who do this for 30 years and couldn't imagine doing anything else. We want to find those high-quality folks that couldn't imagine doing anything else once they are exposed to it.
Outside of your call to action, something that a better and well-supplied mental health care facility and staff and nursing can obviously aid the community it serves. So how do you want to see your work turned around and go beyond the hospital doors?
I would say upon discharge, my goal for the patient that I am helping at that moment is that they will leave with the resources they need to live a productive life. The resources they need to bring them happiness. So that, I guess that would be my goal as a nurse, is that I never want someone to leave and have questions, or I never want someone to leave and still be wondering, what do I do now? I want to try to answer those questions before they leave me.
Mike Lappin is Milwaukee County Behavioral Health Division Administrator, and V. Lucas is a part-time mental health nurse for the county. The Behavioral Health Division hosts a nursing job fair Thursday at the BHD Division Building. You can find more information at WUWM.com.
Next on the show, a question many of us have had about the stuff we set out for recycling. That's on our Beats Me segment when LikeFec continues in a moment on WUWM.
Lake Effect continues now on 89.7 Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski.
Our Beats Me question this week comes from Greenfield resident Anna Raditz.
I just want to know what happens to recycling once it leaves my curb.
She had more on her mind than the next life of her empty milk jugs and newspapers.
The main thing is I wanted to know if people handle this. I mean, if it's all conveyor belts or if people put on plastic gloves and handle it, because I'm really good about rinsing out everything.
I found out Anna's recyclables land in rural Racine County at John's Disposal Services. It handles up to 200 tons a day. Trucks deliver load upon load of recyclables that get fed into a conveyor system, one funneling cardboard, the other everything else recyclable. Manager Eric Burjoyce walks amid the maze of technology.
All the metals and plastics are sorted into a separate conveyor. Cardboard's on this side. If you look on the other side, it's all paper.
A 25-person crew is strategically positioned throughout the system, using their hands, gloved, of course, to further separate metals.
Aerosol cans, regular aluminum with food, and cat food cans will separate out from aluminum cans.
Burjoy says aluminum cans are a valuable commodity, but over time, John's has received fewer and fewer. What John's gets goes to Tennessee, where the Alcoa Company manufactures new aluminum cans and wheels. Paper and cardboard customers are as close as Iowa and as far away as China. Several workers bend over a sea of plastics.
Anything that's not number one, he's going to pull out, put back on the belt for everybody else to sort. Right there, they're doing nothing but milk jugs all day.
Burjoyce says the type of plastic determines its next life. For example, number two colored plastic.
I sell it directly to a guy in Cedar Rapids, and he'll take it and make that into agricultural grain tile.
No one here lays a finger on glass.
This is our glass breaker. When it comes through, the glass will come straight down, get crushed, and then go outside. We're not hand-separating glass.
When it leaves John's, the crushed glass doesn't travel far. 40 miles southwest, a company in Delavan sorts and sells it both to bottle makers and to fiberglass insulation fabricators. There's a market for glass, and it represents about 20% of John's load, so you might be surprised to learn glass isn't a moneymaker at this end of the process.
We pay to get rid of it.
Despite people's best intentions, Burjoy says there's a certain amount of wishful recycling going on. He points to a blanket that ended up in one of the loads trucked to the plant.
They're not quite sure. They would rather err on the side of recycling, so it all goes in the recycling bin.
Wishful recycling adds up, sometimes to as much as 30 tons a day. Johns compacts it and disposes it at the nearest landfill. The plant has to deal with other items that don't belong among the recyclables, especially plastic bags. One line worker stands atop a riser, reaching out to pluck plastic off the line. He's surrounded by bags of every imaginable size and color. While rules vary by municipality, including whether recyclables can be placed at the curb in large plastic bags, Burjoy says any plastic sacks that intermingle with a conveyed recycling stream wrap themselves around equipment and bog down the system.
Two things you'll learn by the time you leave here. Never use a plastic bag and always drink your beer in cans.
Greenfield resident Anna Raditz, who initiated this Beats Me question, says she rarely buys beverages in glass and is trying to do her part to drive down the bag problem creatively.
You make plarn. It's plastic yarn.
Anna is a weaver and has begun turning her plastic bags into yarn. She shows me two tote bags she created.
It keeps it out of the ocean. It keeps it out of the landfills. So I hope they find more and more uses for the recycled products.
Maybe it's time to think outside the recycling box. Speaking of boxes, Eric Burjoyce from John's Disposal says please flatten yours before throwing them into the bin.
To help select Susan's next Beats Me story, go to WUWM.com to vote. Whichever topic wins the vote will be the story Susan produces for February's Beats Me.
One more break, then Madison writer Dean Robbins shares the somewhat overlooked story of a pioneering NASA computer scientist. The story of Margaret Hamilton is next on Lake Effect from Milwaukee's NPR, WUWM. Lake Effect continues on WUWM now. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Not long ago, we introduced you to Kathy Sullivan, a pioneer among women astronauts. Sullivan flew on three space shuttle missions and was the first woman to walk in space. She was in town earlier this year to talk about her book for young readers.
But before Kathy Sullivan walked in space, another pioneering woman helped ensure that there was a successful space program. Margaret Hamilton's story had gone largely unnoticed for decades until relatively recently. Like with Sullivan, a new children's book tells Hamilton's inspirational story. Margaret and the Moon is written by Madison author Dean Robbins, who joined us on the line in November. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Mitch. Thanks for having me.
What turned you on to Margaret Hamilton's story in the first place?
Well, about 3 years ago, I noticed a photograph, an unusual photograph, that was making the rounds on the internet. This was a picture, a black and white photo, of a sort of ordinary-looking woman from the 1960s. She had long, straight hair and wire-rimmed glasses and one of those stylish dresses from the time. But the unusual thing was that she was standing next to a huge stack of paper that went all the way over her head. And you read the caption, and it said this was Margaret Hamilton, who was director of software engineering for NASA's Project Apollo. And at that point, you realized this was no ordinary woman. This was a computer genius who helped astronauts get all the way to the moon for the first time using the extremely limited technology of that era.
Well, and I imagine you, like many of us, upon seeing a photo like that, might have been amazed that there even was software engineering in those days, let alone that it was a woman leading it.
Exactly. And you don't associate women working for NASA back in the 1960s. I think people saw this photograph and were delighted to find out that a woman had played such a pivotal role. And I think they were amazed that they were ready for an indomitable female scientist like Margaret Hamilton.
Well, and the thing that amazes me about this is that even today, in an era that we think we know everything, that we've heard almost every story, there are still great stories just sitting in front of our faces waiting to be told.
Right, especially about women. I think women's contributions have not been recognized. and that's starting to change. When I discovered Margaret's photo, she was a very obscure figure, and her signature achievement had happened in the late 60s and early 70s, and she'd pretty much lived in obscurity since then. And I saw this picture. I decided to investigate for the possibility of writing a children's book about her, but I couldn't find any information. No one else had written a book about Margaret Hamilton. So I put on my journalist hat, and I dug up a phone number and an address for her, and I contacted her and asked if she'd be willing to tell me her story for a children's book.
Well, and that's the other thing that struck me, because, you know, there are stories out there about pioneering and strong women like Amelia Earhart and Susan B. Anthony and Rosa Parks, and they all have in common that, by and large, these are historical figures who are no longer with us. Did it give you pause to portray someone who was still living and breathing?
Well, as a journalist, it was actually kind of exciting because I'd written about Susan B. Anthony and Frederick Douglass and Alice Paul, who were long gone figures. Here was somebody that I could actually speak to. I was a little worried that she wouldn't be interested in talking to me. And in fact, I learned that Margaret is the opposite of a fame seeker. She's a very serious scientist with loads of integrity, and she could have easily said no. But luckily for me, she has grandchildren who are elementary school age. And she said that she was kind of tickled by the thought of a book that she could read to her grandkids, great-grandkids, about her life.
So that was really, I was going to ask, realizing that she would be the better person to answer this question. You sense that the idea of telling this story to a young audience in particular appealed to her?
Yeah, I think the key to Margaret Hamilton, I think, is her interest in problem solving. Ever since she was a little girl, she loved solving problems, whether math problems or philosophical problems or the problems that girls and women face in a sexist society. And I think that she likes the idea of young girls reading about somebody who went through this and maybe identifying with her and identifying with the strong female heroine.
How much time did you get to spend chatting with her as this book sort of came into focus for you?
Well, she really warmed up to the idea of giving me lots of information for the book. So we spoke on the phone several times, and we exchanged emails, and she shared all sorts of technical details about the work that she did. And as she was telling me all this stuff, I thought, well, this is way too complicated for an elementary school kid to understand. And I asked her if she could explain it in a way that maybe an 8-year-old might be able to comprehend. And she absolutely couldn't do that because she's not used to thinking of her work in that way. So it fell to me as an English major to simplify the story so in a way that young children might understand. And I was worried how Margaret would take that when she saw the final draft of the manuscript, but she was very magnanimous and told me that she thought that it had captured the spirit of her story.
Well, and we keep kind of talking around her story. Can you share what the real significant thing, you know, this picture of her next to the code, which is actually portrayed in the illustrations in your book, is really interesting. But there's this sort of little known or maybe little remembered aspect to the Apollo 11 mission that she played a huge role in. What was that?
Right. Well, I guess I should say first that she was a pioneering computer scientist at a time when there were very few women in that field. And she rose to director of software engineering for NASA's Project Apollo, helping to write the code that got astronauts all the way to the moon for the first time. And there was no roadmap for using computers in that way back then, so Margaret had to make up these solutions as she went along. So this signature achievement that you're talking about, which is the climax of Margaret and the Moon, Apollo 11 mission was hurtling toward the moon, and the lunar module was about to land on the lunar surface. And all of a sudden, the spaceship's computer started to overload because the astronaut made a tiny mistake. And it looked like the lunar module might actually crash on the moon or might have to abort the mission. Well, Margaret Hamilton's brilliant computer programming saved the day. With her knack for anticipating problems, she had thought about what might happen if an astronaut did make a mistake and the computer started to overload. So she had programmed it in such a way that the computer would ignore all the extra tasks that were flooding in and just focus on the most important task, which was landing the spaceship on the moon. And that's what happened. And at that moment, she became a legend of the United States space program.
How tricky is portraying the historical context for this story when you're telling it for kids who grow up in an era of, you know, first of all, Title IX, and also at a time when, you know, there are many people telling girls and boys as well that they can grow up to become anything?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there were a lot of elements to this story. There was the whole context of NASA, and there was the sexism of the 1960s and 70s. And the first draft of the manuscript I wrote was extremely long because there was so much to tell. And so it was really a process of paring away and getting down to the essence of the story and really focusing on what was most dramatic and important about Margaret's story. And I hope it turned out okay.
Right, yeah. I mean, kids today, you know, take it for granted that there are people, you know, orbiting the Earth at every moment in the International Space Station. And, you know, I wonder if it's an eye-opener to some of them that that it really was not all that long ago when it was pretty unusual to be able to put someone up in space.
Mm-hmm. When I visit schools, I tell the story about the effort to put people on the moon for the first time. And kids are moderately excited about this. When I get around at the end of my presentation to telling them that now there's a Margaret Hamilton Lego toy, that's what gets them extraordinarily excited. So that they can relate to.
For someone who was tickled to have her story told to a young audience, I imagine she must have been likewise tickled to have a Lego immortalize her.
I think she was. You know, I think she's kind of immune to that sort of celebrity thing, but I did see a picture of her posing with the Women of NASA Lego set, so at least part of her must have been excited about that. I know that when my son was young, there were no female figures in any of his Lego sets, so I think it's just so exciting that now NASA is paying all this attention to women heroines like Margaret Hamilton.
Can you talk about the illustrations in this book? Because they add another whole dimension to the story.
Oh, the illustrations are wonderful. So Lucy Nicely is a brilliant comics artist. She's written best-selling autobiographical graphic novels like Relish and Displacement. And she brought so much of her wry sensibility to the book. She also pulled off this tricky tone that I sort of had in mind from the start, which is that the book would be both playful and sort of cosmic. There's some of her illustrations just make me laugh out loud because they're so witty, and others are just absolutely sublime. Like she's got a 2-page spread of the young Margaret Hamilton just gazing up into the universe.
So, do you have any sense for how Margaret Hamilton's great grandchildren are taking to the story?
Well, she sent me a photograph of a friend's child reading Margaret and the Moon, so I think she's happy with it. I've also sent her pictures of kids at school visits that I've done dressed up as Margaret Hamilton and holding projects that they've done about Margaret Hamilton and her great work. And I think she's been really, really excited to see that.
Well, Dean Robbins, it is it's a story I knew very little about before reading Margaret and the Moon as well. So job well done.
Thank you. Thank you, Mitch.
Dean Robbins is a Wisconsin children's book author. His titles include Two Friends, Susan B. Anthony and Frederick Douglass, Miss Paul and the President, and his latest, Margaret and the Moon. We reached him on the line from Madison in November. And that's today's edition of the show. I'm Audrey Nowakowski.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Thanks so much for tuning in today, and I sure hope you'll be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another Lake Effect on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Stay tuned. Fresh air is next.